Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
BT Sport Pods.
Hi, welcome to Michael Calvin's Football People. I'm joined by Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst, and by David Priest, the coach and commentator. As two ex-pros, I suspect they'll relate to much of my conversation with Jamie Vardy. That's coming later. First, though, the Champions League. All four Premier League teams have made it to the last 16. Tottenham joined the party with a last-kick win in Marseille. Yet, typically, they generated more questions than answers. They might also be third in the league. But, Aid, we don't really know how good they are, do we?
No, I guess not. They're not a good first half team, that is for sure. Far better, aren't they, in the second half. They're sort of making life really, really difficult for themselves, aren't they? With these sluggish opening spells. It's a great result in the context of the group. They've gone to Marseille, a difficult place to be. Cauldron of an atmosphere, and they've nicked a win. So well done to them. But I think we can all see with our own eyes that there's a lot of work that needs to be done by Antonio Conte to get that team up to a level where they can actually challenge in the Champions League or challenge in the Premier League. I think, yeah, that they're still far too reliant on the front two. An example of that, again, with Højbjerg scoring that great goal at the end. It was a really, really good goal. Højbjerg is the third most creative player for Spurs this season in terms of creating chances. Now, I don't think we would have him down as that type of player. He's having a great campaign. I'll give him that. But I think what it shows you is there's a dearth of players that connect what is a workmanlike side in behind Kane and Son. They struggle to connect those guys with the front two unless it's on those ruthless counter-attacks. So there's work to be done. I think that he probably needs to strengthen at wing-back, strengthen at centre-half. But yeah, he's an efficient manager that produces ruthless winning football, isn't he, Antonio Conte? And Spurs will still win more than they lose under him, no doubt about that. But yeah, the jury's out on how good they are.
Well, everything does seem to centre on Conte, doesn't it, Dave? You know, there seems always to be an edge with him. You know, talk about, Juventus, if this all goes pear-shaped at Spurs. I suppose the real question is his tactical caution suffocating his team?
I think when people, when he came in and his style of play and the way it's progressed, there's been a lot of comparisons with Jose Mourinho. The real difference between them is that Mourinho went to get ahead early in games and held on to it. The other side with Conte is that they seem very cautious, sort of very, very safe in that, especially in the opening 45 minutes, and then go for it in the second half, which doesn't always work. It's a gamble. But I think Hugo Ruiz said they played with fear first half. You could see that they played with fear. They couldn't connect passes. It made it really difficult for them, especially when Marseille, you know, it was a lot clearer to them what they had to do. And I think you've seen that when Tottenham went 1-0 behind, it gave them a sort of clarity, right? This is what we've got to do. We've got to go forward. We've got to be more aggressive, you know, press. They changed things a little bit in that second half where it ended up being more like a 4-5-1 in the first half. And it was difficult for them to get out. As soon as it went to kind of like a 5-3-2 and they could press from the middle of the pitch and they can press higher up, it was a totally different game for them. But I also think it's a huge handicap not having the manager at the side of the pitch. I think that especially early in the game, it's almost like when a club doesn't have a manager and don't have that focal point, don't have that authority in the club, it's almost the same. The pitch, you can feel it on the pitch, I know from experience. And it's probably one thing that, you know, you talk about Conte being on the edge all the time, whatever the topic is. But certainly on the sidelines, it's like that as well. And that's the danger, you know, of being like that and being so emotional that you're going to risk missing games for your team.
Yeah, his personality does dominate that club, doesn't it? Now, knockout stages, obviously qualifying for those is a huge financial boost to Spurs' aid. Conte will expect that money to be spent in January, won't he?
I suppose some of it, yeah. He'll probably want one or two additions. The last few January transfer windows have been virtual non-events, though, haven't they? I don't think we should get overexcited. There might be one or two clubs on the back of the World Cup that want to take the plunge on players that shine over there in Qatar. We'll have to wait and see. But yeah, I wouldn't expect radical changes. I just think they need to evolve a little bit more as a team. And yeah, but have the confidence to start matches better and not rely so much on the counter-attacks. I mean, they absorb a lot, don't they? I was looking at the numbers. I mean, I watched the game against Brighton. You'd have thought they were playing against, you know, Bayern Munich, the way they were sort of packed on the edge of their own 18-yard box with, you know, three defenders, then the two wing-backs, three players sat in front of them. It was very, very defensive. And you look at the numbers and only four teams have faced more shots than Spurs, which is remarkable given that they are one of the top teams in the country. So yeah, I would, if I was a Spurs fan, I'd be looking to evolve and develop more of a more sustained pressure and just to be able to score goals when you wear teams down at the other end of the pitch, because the more touches Kane and Son and Kulusevski and Moura have, surely the more chance they have of you know, hurting teams.
Mm. Well, Liverpool are at Spurs on Sunday. Do you expect that to be an agenda-setting game, Dave?
I think every week in the Premier League, the agendas change depending on the results. I know there's been a lot of talk about, you know, this seven-year itch with Klopp, and it's remarkable, really, when people talk about it in a real negative way, say, oh, well, you know, after 7 years at a club, then he's finished. You know, that's the end of his time. 400 games into his tenure at Liverpool, and he's hit a rocky patch, you know, when most managers don't even get 18 months. I think it's a ridiculous comment to use against him. But for me, it's Klopp is anywhere near the end of his tenure at Liverpool. This is nothing that one or two transfer windows can't change. And, you know, you look around and you look at the options. Who's the best man to lead Liverpool for? Of course, it's Jurgen Klopp. And they've changed a little bit in the way that they play. The dynamic of the midfield has changed from 2 or 3 years ago. But I was really impressed with Napoli last night as well. I think Napoli's midfield was kind of like what you would like to see, or what Klopp would like to see their midfield be like, dynamic, you know, Anguissa, Laboca, and Dembele. It was really a really dynamic midfield three. I thought it was really interesting the first couple of first 10, 15 minutes where it was really high tempo. There's lots of high pressing, lots of turnover of ball. Of course, people are always going to say that's the problem for Liverpool at the moment, is that midfield.
Yeah, sure. I suppose there was a modicum of reassurance in that win over Napoli. When you think about it, Mo Salah is still the most prolific player in the competition. Darwin Nunez, another goal for him, and he's well on the way to being a folk hero. You know, he's almost Ibrahimovic light, isn't he?
I do like him. I do like Darwin Nunez. He's got some energy about him. He's a trier. He will make run after run after run and until he gets in. I think he'll always get chances. He reminds me a little bit of Fernando Torres, you know, the younger version of him, with the electricity about his play. But I do think he's a good player that will enliven them, not just this season, but for a few years. When you think about Luis Diaz, who's out at the moment as well, then that's two of the front three that have come in and injected fresh life. I think the next objective, as Preecy says, is to fix the rest of the team. I think Henderson, Fabinho, Thiago, Firmino, that's the axis, isn't it? That's the bit where they're all over 30. A couple of those might have to fall by the wayside for for younger players in their early 20s to come in and add that dynamism that maybe Napoli have got. I've got nothing against over 30s. I've been there as a player myself. But to have six or seven in your team, which was what was happening a little bit earlier in the season, is too many. Do you agree on that, Preecy? I mean, I just feel that in terms of sometimes you work out of possession, just that ability to recover and cover for teammates, that fades a little bit when you've got too many over 30s in the team.
Yeah, I think when people looked at the data, they've seen that the pressing data has sort of dropped from peak Liverpool. And I know that there's a lot of people being criticised in the sort of the transfer dealings and the policy, saying that, you know, it's kind of like we've got a number one target and nothing else. Not that there isn't other names on the list, it's just that if we don't get them, then we'd rather have nobody. Well, the problem with that is it's okay, you can be loyal to players, you know, he knows he can rely on certain individuals. But the problem with that is that Manchester City are doing it, and Manchester City are evolving and sort of drip feeding players into their squad. Yeah, it will be a problem, but certainly it's something that if we're looking at it, and Jurgen Klopp certainly knows what needs to be done, and the next two transfer windows are going to be huge for them, I think.
And he's also, Mike, recognised the need for a bit of change, maybe recognised that it has got a bit stale by changing the system, hasn't he? He's gone that 4-4-2 or the diamond. And I think that, yeah, I think he knows the team needs to be freshened up. What was interesting in the game against Napoli was Konate coming in. I've watched Liverpool quite a lot in recent weeks, and Joe Gomez has struggled. I don't want to dig him out too much, but he hasn't been in great form. And I do think that Konate, with his pace coupled with Virgil van Dijk's pace, will enhance that back four moving forward. So, and I think he had a good game against Napoli.
Yeah, right on cue. Been stories in the German press on Wednesday morning about €100 million bid for Jude Bellingham from Liverpool. You know, frankly, that's not going to be enough, is it? But which tells you the way the market's going. And I suppose is it time really to get real, Dave, in terms of, I know before the Napoli game, Klopp was talking about European success being pretty much impossible because of their inconsistency. Again, being realistic, is retaining a top four place their principal target this season?
Yeah, I think it has to be. You know, they can't rely on winning the Champions League. And far from me to disagree with somebody like Jurgen Klopp, but I also think it can work in their favour as well. We always hear of teams that aren't doing well in the league, you know, having a, you know, the cup games giving them a break and a different kind of focus away from that. So I think that can happen with Liverpool. And they certainly, listen, you can't rule them out. You can rule them out of the Premier League probably, but you can't rule them out of winning the Champions League, certainly.
Yeah, they're too good a team, aren't they? They're too good a team to be written off right now. There's every chance they can come back and finish second or third, potentially. I mean, it's a tall order, but you know, they've got a bit of pedigree in there. On Jude Bellingham, by the way, has a player ever been more suitable to a team than Jude Bellingham to Liverpool? I just can't think of one. I think he would absolutely solve a multitude of issues for Jurgen Klopp and that Liverpool team. He was tailor-made for them. Yeah, if I were in their shoes, I'd be trying to cultivate that relationship and make it happen in the summer.
Well, if you think of the goal threat they had with Genie Wijnaldum when he was at his peak, you know, they kind of missed that. You know, the three midfield last night, Milner, Fabinho and Thiago, yes, they're very good players, of course, in their own right, but they're not the ones that are going to do the job of getting in the box and get goals as well. So they miss that as well, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Is there also a sense, Aide, that, you know, everyone around in that sort of top four, top six area is now being threatened by Newcastle?
I think so, yeah, definitely. Newcastle have been outstanding, haven't they? Best defensive record in the division. Callum Wilson, certainly one of the most informed strikers. Miguel Amaron, one of the most informed players in the division. I mean, Newcastle fans must be so excited at what's happening at St James's Park. And what can trip them up? I suppose injuries and suspensions in the second half of the season perhaps is where they might fall by the wayside. But they look nailed on for top eight, don't they? And it's, can they break into that big six? I think they look capable of it, no doubt about it. I mean, Eddie Howe, his coaching, the way he's improved the players as individuals and then improved the collective, deserves high praise. He's been outstanding.
What about Chelsea, Dave? Small earthquake in Brighton. Few egos bruised.
Yeah, I think you look at Graham's interviews after the game, and there was an element of shock there. I think he's probably shocked at the reception that he got from the Brighton crowd as well. I think he was disappointed in that. Very disappointed. I don't think anybody could have blamed him for leaving, you know. So there's that, but also the scoreline suggested it was a different game. Of course, they had their own chances, and it could have been a lot more level than it actually turned out to be. But I think this is the one thing that Graham's not had before, that's real expectation, and that every game, you know, it'll only take 90 minutes, like you said yesterday. It only takes 90 minutes for a crisis to appear, or for it to feel like a crisis. I think it's probably one thing he's got to get used to is that he just has to bat those questions away, really. He's got to get better at sort of deflecting those questions or absorbing them a little bit more than looking like it is a crisis or that it is going to affect him. And of course, again, I don't want to tell a manager of Graham's what he should be doing, but yeah. I think you're going to expect more than that in the future as well, because it doesn't matter how well you're doing, and he has had a great start. Mm. You know, there's going to be more moments like this.
Mm. Well, I suppose the irony is, isn't it, Nade, that you know, here we've got a training ground coach denied time on the grass simply because the schedule is so insane this month in particular.
Yeah, it's a very unusual time, isn't it? And yeah, not ideal. So in that sense, as Preecy points out, it's been pretty good because he hasn't had that much time to work on the training ground. He's mixed and matched his teams, hasn't he? He's rotated very, very heavily, taking a good look at everybody in the squad, isn't he? So, look, he won't have many players there, will he, during the World Cup? A lot of them will be away, so that time will be denied him as well. But, yeah, David is absolutely right about the pressure and the expectation. That was the risk in appointing him, wasn't it? Because he's not worked at a club that size before. I think he'll be fine. He'll just have to learn on that job. And tactically, he got a lot of stick, didn't he, for putting Sterling and Pulisic as wing-backs. But, I mean, it's something that has already worked for them in other games. It worked for them a lot at Brighton. So, yeah, I don't think we should sort of hammer him for that. It's he is always going to be a coach that tries things. And his track record suggests that when he experiments, he gets it right a lot more often than he gets it wrong. So, yeah, it was a horrible day for him. Bit embarrassing, wasn't it, to get hammered by Brighton. But, yeah, he's still a very, very good tactician.
I think just going back to what he had said about the numbers left at the training ground during the World Cup, I think you're actually talking potentially single figures in that first-team squad, in that immediate first-team squad. So, where a lot of managers, you know, look at somebody further down the leagues, like Michael Carrick going into Middlesbrough, those few weeks that they have off because of the World Cup, they can focus on something, they've got something to work on. They can use that really constructively, where, you know, there's very little that Graham's going to be able to do in that time.
And it's difficult for someone like Raheem Sterling. He's taking him out of his comfort zone a little bit, asking him to do different things, think outside the box. And then he's going to go off with England for, we hope, the full month or the full 5 weeks, and then come back and be asked to pick that up straight away. It's not going to be easy. So, yeah, I think we won't see the best of Chelsea. We won't see them in a full flow until later in the season, in my opinion. He's not a coach that will get his team, because there's so much information he's imparting on the players, so much new stuff. It's never going to just click just like that.
Yeah, well, lest we forget, Erling Haaland will be hanging about the place at Manchester City for a few weeks. You know, and he's obviously going to be a unique asset in a unique season. With City, Dave, are they justifiable favourites to win the Champions League?
Possibly, but whenever there's a competition, certainly Champions League and Real Madrid's in the mix, then, you know, he's always going to be there as well. But again, I don't think there's any worries about Manchester City until you get the semi-finals and finals, and then we see what Pep comes up with that he's never done before. You know, what he can think of. And I mean, he must be getting to a point now where he's done everything, so perhaps it's less of a risk. But I have a lot of arguments or a lot of conversations with people in the game about Erling Haaland and his role at Manchester City. And a lot of people still won't be convinced until he does it at that level in those games against the big sides. There's no question his quality, of course, there isn't, but I think that it is ominous that he's going to be, have himself a little rest to go for the second half of the season, where a lot of teams are going to be sort of, yeah, they're going to be at a deficit fitness-wise.
Certainly. What about overall, Aid? I wouldn't mind focusing on Portuguese football and the advance of teams like Benfica, Porto. What always amazes me about them is their ability to replenish after losing their best talents. European football has always been their shop window. Does that then limit the extent of their achievements? You know, are we looking at Portuguese football as, okay, get in the last 16, maybe nick a place in the last 8, but no more?
Yeah, I mean, they can probably shoot a little bit higher than that, can't they? They've shown that in this season's Champions League. Benfica were more than a match for PSG in that particular game. So that will have given them heart. Porto finished the campaign really strongly. But yeah, I think they do know their place in the food chain, don't they, Portuguese clubs? They know that they don't have the finances. So what do? They invest maybe more time and energy into their scouting and recruitment and that side of things, just to bring in players that have potential. And they also develop good coaches, don't they? I mean, how many smart Portuguese coaches are there around? And I mean, it's an incredible amount. So, yeah, they know then that they're not a heavyweight in European football, so they concentrate on what they can do better than other nations potentially. And yeah, you've got to admire it. You have to. They just have to. It's like any underdog. You've got to work that little bit harder to keep pace with the rest. And that's what Portuguese teams do. And they're also very good, aren't they, at saying, look, go and better yourself. We're not going to stand in your way, whether it's a coach or a player. They let them go and they move on and they just regenerate. It's pretty impressive. And a good example for other countries around Europe outside of those so-called big leagues.
I think it's absolutely amazing what they're doing in Portugal. You look at if you take a top 10 clubs in Europe, for transfer fees received, you have Porto, Sporting Lisbon in that, and Benfica right at the top. It's just incredible what they can achieve. And if you look at something like Benfica, where they have 300 people involved in their recruitment at all levels.
Really? I didn't know that.
In their scouting system. And I think even with Sporting and Porto, they themselves have another 300 between them as well. Mm-hmm. And it's just incredible. And their focus, not just, you know, they produce players and managers, but with the players, some like Benfica, they don't worry about results at youth level. They're not trying to win leagues at youth or trophies at youth level. It's very player-centred. They try to produce players, not teams. And it's obviously a system that works for them. And with in regards to the coaches, I've been on a few coaching courses in Scotland and England here, and there's lots of Portuguese come over, right from Mourinho doing his coaching badges at Largs in Scotland with Scottish FA. I think that sort of encouraged a lot of Portuguese coaches. So it's not the coaching system itself over there that's producing these coaches, but what they do is, one, they promote young coaches. A lot of the coaches that have come across started coaching in their early 20s. They all come from an academic background. And the biggest thing for me is that they're encouraged to come up with their own creative ideas. So they're not just copying a template from somebody else and then adding those little bits. They're really encouraged to be creative with the way that they try and approach games. And of course, with the top three, they're so dominant more often than not. They have to be creative in their tactics to try and break down the other sides, who are usually quite defensive in their approach, to make sure that they can then try and get results from them. So that there's just so many sort of aspects to the way they do things in Portugal that's conducive to what's happening now.
Yeah, well, when you think about it, it's logical to assume that the next manager coach to leave will be Ruben Amorim at Sporting Lisbon. I would expect to see him in the Premier League within a year, I would have thought. It's interesting, that there's almost been a corresponding decline in representation from La Liga. Yeah. Atletico Madrid, that's the end of an era, the Simeone era, you know, the failure to qualify. And I suppose when you think about it, it's little wonder that the biggest losers from the group stage, and I'm thinking of Barcelona, Juventus, they're pushing so hard for a Super League.
Yeah, yeah, but the structure behind the scenes isn't good enough, is it? And they've not been managed properly, I guess, as well, from, you know, in terms of off the pitch work. So yeah, no wonder they're clamouring for the Super League. Those clubs, they've bullied the rest of Europe in the past with their financial muscle, but they can't do it at the moment. COVID obviously hit every league hard, but it seems that the Premier League was the most resilient to that, and those in Italy and particularly Spain have come out of it significantly weaker, haven't they? And it's an issue for them. I still don't really want the Super League to happen, but those clubs will continue pushing. On Simeone, he's on such big money, isn't he? Is he one of the best paid managers in the world? I just don't think they can afford to get rid of him.
Mm. Well, Jamie Vardy, by contrast to all that elitist manoeuvring, is football's everyman. Discarded at 16, Premier League record at 35. He spans the generations and the chasm between the grassroots and the elite. Here's a fascinating insight into his career.
Jamie, thanks very much, first of all, for joining us. You're 35, Premier League record breaker. You've had a fantastic career. When you look back at yourself at 16, released by your boyhood club, and, you know, with respect, probably go through the motions a bit at college, what do you see when you look back at yourself? And maybe who do you see?
Not me. No, it was, you know, it was a tough one. Obviously, going through the academy system and stuff. When you're a kid, you think that's all you're going to be. So school got put on the back burner. I mean, weren't allowed to do a lot of stuff at school anyway because of the academy. So I couldn't do like sports for school and stuff like that either. So really did get put on the back burner. And then you get released and you think, oh dear, where do I go from here? And there was only one place I could go, really, and that was into work.
Because in a weird way, did Wednesday do you a favour? Because if you think about it, if you'd have become a scholar, you'd have gone through the sort of tippy-tappy development football that there is, and the odds are that, you know, you'd be in that massive group that fall away from the game between the ages of, say, 17 and 20. Instead, you went into men's football and you thrived and you showed people what you were capable of.
I think that definitely benefited me. I mean, don't get me wrong, the academies nowadays are way advanced to what it was back then. But no, definitely playing against, like you say, fully grown men, like centre-halves, 30-year-old, no-nonsense, definitely toughened me up and showed me that side of the game that I probably wouldn't have got if I'd have gone into, say, the scholars.
Mm. What do you think made you a career? Because that question really is almost like twofold. And there's a sort of personal side to it and the professional side. Let's start, if we could, with the personal side. Speaking to Patrick Vieira last week, and he made the point that his background, you know, the streets, the estates, almost breeds the right type of person for professional football, which can be, you know, quite a brutal business, and you need, you know, great strength of character to succeed in it. Do you agree with that?
I think everyone's different. Some people just have it naturally, whereas others might need to be taught it, and it's hard to get taught, which I think probably my teaching of it was going in and playing, like you say, lower league men's football when I was young, like quite a young age. So that probably toughened me up from that side of it. But again, it's a benefit to me, like throughout my career, and made me the player that I am.
Mm. What were the biggest lessons in the early stages of your career that you drew from that sort of non-league, you know, Halifax and then on to Fleetwood?
get back up and laugh. That's the main one. If you show them signs that you're hurt, it's game over. So get back up, laugh. Make sure that next time there's a tackle, it's you're the one that's going in just as tough as them and letting them know that they're in a game. It's like anything, that look and see a slight young lad and they think all the birthdays have come at once, but if you can get on top of that and go in with like all the strength that you've got and use your weight to your advantage, then that definitely helps.
Yeah, because there's so many preconceived ideas, aren't there? You know, you talk about how they look at you and think, oh, well, he's not quite big enough. You know, that's what scouts said, isn't it, really? They saw the natural qualities you've got, your pace and your ability to score goals, but, you know, is he big enough, basically? Mm-hmm. Which is a bit of a cop-out, isn't it, really? I first saw you play at Fleetwood at Forest Green in the conference, about 2010, 2011, something
2011.
Like that. 2011. Yeah. Now, I was with a bunch of scouts for a book I was writing. They all saw your natural qualities, but none of them would put their name on you. In other words, yeah, we've got to go and get this kid. What did Leicester see that they didn't?
I couldn't tell you. I remember just before I signed it, I came for a visit around the old training ground and sat down with the director of football at the time, Steve Walsh, and he literally brought out a booklet of match reports from all their different scouts and how many times they'd been to watch. And he basically said that I ticked every single box that they wanted in a player, as well as what I was like off the pitch as well. So as soon as I saw that and saw obviously the amount of time that they'd taken to be scouting me, there was never no other option where I was going.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that, you know, if you look at your professional qualities, you see things slightly earlier than others on a pitch, and you've got that pace to get yourself in the position to actually exploit that. Is that a conscious thing, or is it just instinctive, you know, the movement that you have and you know, your eye for a flow of the game?
I think some of it's natural, some's instinct, but I also think that you have to be analysing games as well. You've got to, if something's not gone well for you the previous game, for instance, you look back and you see what you could have done better or what different run you could have made. And I think it's always like that. You can never be too old to still be learning. You can learn things, obviously, for the rest of your life. It's all about if you take it on board and if you're wanting to actually learn and improve.
Because, you know, you're part now of, I suppose we can call it like the Dropbox generation, where you'll get your clips fed into you. In terms of preparing for a game, how concentrated are you on those, you know, pieces of analysis?
Yeah, you have to look at them. So, like I said, each game's different. Each team you play against will set up in a different way, or they'll build up in a different way, or when we're attacking, they'll defend in a completely different way. So you always have to keep analysing every single team you're playing. So we do that week on week basis. And like I said, you take on board what you think personally would help you and the team, and you try to see if they'll work out.
Because when you're on the pitch, a move is maybe building up. What are you actually reading? Are you reading a defender's body shape or the intention of the teammate to provide a certain type of ball? You know, what are you seeing in that moment or during those moments?
You have to see it all. It's hard work, don't get me wrong, but like I say, you have to see where the defender is at the minute, or where you think he's going to position himself when, like you say, your teammate's coming through with the ball. Then it's what's going to be the better ball for your teammate to play that'll advance you up the pitch, or what would be the better ball for me to receive myself. You have to take on quite a lot, and it's 9 times out of 10, it's within the split of a moment. You've got to do what you think's right at that moment in time. But again, when it's like that quick, it then comes down to your instinct, which naturally a lot of people have got, but some haven't.
When you get in front of a goal, what takes over? Because, you know, I've been told by so many different types of sportsmen, snooker players, golfers especially, they say, look, there are times when they're just in the zone. You know, everything slows down, everything's chilled. and they just do it. Is that the same for you when you've got a chance in front of you, a shooting chance or whatever it might be?
A lot of the time, yeah. I mean, I've had this question quite a lot. Are you looking at the keeper? Or, yeah, well, I've seen clips on the keeper and how he might come out for a one-on-one, for instance. But a lot of it in that moment in time is just instinct. You've literally got less than a second to decide what you're going to do. So it has to come down to a lot of your natural ability. But like I say, you still have to do the bit of research before that game on how you see the keeper coming out, for instance.
Does that suggest to you that goal scorers are born and not made?
I think some are, but it can be made as well. Like I say, it's all in the art of learning. Yeah, you might have that natural ability that can get yourself far, but you've still got to have that eagerness to want to learn and want to be able to do things slightly different to what you've been naturally doing for the past 5-10 years when you were a bit younger, for instance.
Mm. Out of all the players you've played with and against, I know this is a big question, but who's the best striker that you've played with or against, and why?
With, I always say the same answer, and it's one of my old teammates, David Nugent. And it's sheerly on how we were together as a partnership. Everything just clicked, everything worked.
There's this sort of telepathic thing, yeah?
Just both knew exactly what the other was going to do, so the other striker would do the complete opposite. It worked an absolute treat, and always enjoyed my time when I was playing up front with Nuge. So that's, for me, always been my best partnership.
And what about people you played against?
It's a tough one. There's that many. Yeah. That many.
It comes with being 35, mate.
I know, the joys. I think when you look at it, like players you've played against, you can never been fortunate enough to play against like Messi, Neymar, and you've seen what they've done throughout their career as well. It's been frightening. So I think you'd have to put like them two definitely up there.
Yeah, because their ability almost to manipulate the ball, isn't it? It's just crazy.
Well, I mean, it's like they've got glue stuck to the feet. It's frightening. They get themselves out of any sticky situation that they're in and you know full well that they're always going to provide.
Yeah. You know, I alluded to it a little bit earlier, your record. You know, the first player to score 100 Premier League goals after turning 30. What's behind your longevity as a player, do you think?
Looking after myself. Made sure I've got all the equipment that I'd need to do recovery that's in my house. So even when we've had a recovery session here, for instance, I'll then go home and carry on doing the extra at home just to make sure that I'm fully fresh and obviously ready to go again for the next day.
Because that's something I think that people don't realise is the extent of almost like the self-help that the top players do. You know, I was speaking to someone about Vinicius Junior at Real Madrid the other day, and he has a couple of mates who live with him, so that's the social side taken out, almost like they're his minders almost when he goes out. But he doesn't have any say in what he eats. He has a live-in chef, live-in sports scientist / physio. The club just supply data after every session and they work on his own personal welfare, if you like. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be the future, do you think? That more players, because of everything around the game now, the celebrity, the money, everything else, it's an amazing profession to be in. And, with every year you can stay in it, obviously you get the benefits from it.
I think it'll probably go more down that side, especially with, like you said, how football is now with, like, sports scientists, data, your fitness coaches wanting you to do X amount of kilometres a day so that you're fresh for a game and stuff like that. Yeah, it definitely will. And like you said, just adding that extra bit in at home definitely benefited myself, for instance. So,
what sort of stuff do you have at home? Is it like sort of the hyperbaric chambers or the cold
the cryos?
The cryos, yeah.
Yeah, I've got them all. just to make sure.
And do you, is that a regular thing that you use them?
I use them as and when you, the cryo's probably the main one that gets used, because there was proof that it can help with sleep as well, but I don't sleep anyway, so that's completely contradicts that. But no, it's just, it's good for obviously getting all the lactic acid out of muscles and stuff like that, and obviously the hyperbaric chambers, known for helping muscles recover quicker, so you don't have to be in them long. It's 40 minutes stint in the hyperbaric and literally 2-3 minutes in the cryo, so anything to give you that little, even if it's a 1% advantage, then it adds up.
Yeah, small margins, isn't it? And I suppose, you know, do you think that calling time on your international career as you did, has that helped you sustain yourself at club level?
I think so, definitely, yeah. It's given me that time to have the rest when needed, or when the club think I need a couple of extra days, then international breaks now are perfect for that. Get to fully refresh and make sure that I'm fully ready when the season starts up and running again.
Yeah, because it's a strange season, this one, isn't it? But I suppose in a way, because of the World Cup break, that can play into your hands, can't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we obviously know that we'll probably get a bit of time off, which will, like I said, be good for the recovery, but we also know that we've got to be back in and making sure we're ready and ready to go for Boxing Day, so, or maybe on the 20th, depending if we get through in the Cup. So still got to make sure that you're keeping up on top of your fitness in whatever break you get, and make sure that you come back fit and ready to go.
Do you think there'll be any pangs of regret when you're watching England in Qatar?
What about just giving it up?
Yeah, that could have been me, yeah.
No, not at all. I'm happy to sit there and cheer them on. Like I said, I think it's benefited me in still being able to be playing for Leicester at 35. So it was a decision that I made, always stood by, and one that I'll not regret.
I know it's dangerous to look forward too far into the future.
I was gonna say, I look till tomorrow.
You know, you've got a contract till June 2024. Mm-hmm. How long do you think you can stay in the game?
Who knows? That's the million-dollar question. Get asked all the time. You never know. And the only thing I can say is, it's however long my legs will keep me going. I'm sure they'll be the first thing that tell me they've had enough. As soon as that happens, then that'll be the day.
Mm. And when that day comes, do you think you'll try and stay in the game?
It's not really something I've thought about. All I know is, like, football's so physical and so mentally, like, draining, where you're having to, like I say, you're having to have them shut-offs. You need to completely forget about it. So it's not something I've looked at, but I'll definitely be looking at it soon.
Do you still sort of replay games over in your mind? Sort of, you know, 'cause I know quite a few players who basically can't get to sleep until sort of 3 o'clock in the morning after a game, simply because it's still whizzing around in their minds.
No, with the adrenaline stuff, I'm shocking after a game for sleeping. But I'm also one of them that tries not to think about the game. I know full well we've got another game coming up. So that game's done, it's in the back now. So just concentrate. I think with stuff like that, like, with all my achievements, I've always said it's not something I've really had chance to look back on. It's something that I'll probably be trying to fully cram into when I've finished.
And of all the achievements that you've had, what one meant the most to you?
To me, you know, I'd probably say, it's not even a personal one, it was us doing the Great Escape and staying in the Prem. Because I think that was what we needed to then kick on, like, the following season and have the stability that we've had for the past 8-9 years.
And as a final point, probably go back to the start. There's a 16-year-old listening to this chat, and he's in the position that you found yourself in.
Mm-hmm.
What's your advice to him?
Never give up. There was plenty of times where I wanted to, trust me, but... like you were saying earlier, I mean, I stopped playing. I was just working part-time. Went to college. Luckily at college, bumped into another one of the lads who'd just been released at the same time as me. And he was like, oh, just come and play with us on a Sunday. So I was like, you know what, why not? Got nothing to lose. Just playing with a group of mates. Went from there to, like you say, Stocksbridge. Worked my way up into the first team, and then Halifax, Fleetwood, Leicester, and not look back.
Mm. Never give up. It's not a bad way to live your life, is it, really?
Not at all.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks, brilliant. James. Thank you.
Cheers, Bob.
Well, I found that chat really interesting and actually probably not what was expected. A lot more thoughtful and invigorating in many ways. Adrian, I thought the key message at the end, don't give up. That's really powerful, isn't it, for any aspiring player out there?
It is, yeah. But resilience is what you need in bucket loads, really, to make it as a professional footballer in the first place and then to stay there. It's just so many ups and downs. You're going to have so many knocks and you just can't give up, because to one manager, you might be pretty worthless, you know, a sub, a squad player, someone they don't care about. But to someone else, you're a key man and you're the same player. So you should never lose heart and never give up. And you just got to find the right place, providing you've got the right ability and desire to be a footballer. And I thought that was a good message. And what was also really interesting, and it backs up that never give up is really his mantra, because when you asked him for, you know, sort of greatest achievements, he didn't say the title win. He said the greatest game. He said the greatest game, which in that season, Leicester didn't give up. I watched them that season and they were awful. They were in a right state. So for them to survive, they had to believe they couldn't give up, and they didn't. So yeah, that was, yeah, it was a really good interview. And yeah, I think that's a big message at the end.
Yeah, I thought we had almost an understated masterclass in the art of scoring goals or forward play. As a goalkeeper, David, what can you take from his insights into the art of forward play?
I think that in general that your strikers are a really good source for goalkeepers and goalkeeping coaches, just to get in the mindset in this situation. You know, what's going through your mind? What do you think in this situation? But I think that it's really interesting about when Jamie talks about his preparation for games and sort of how he looks at goalkeepers and if he can find chinks in their armour, can he take advantage of it? And I think, certainly myself, you probably underestimated him a little bit in the way that he thinks about the game. And it's interesting to think that when he's talking about, you know, yeah, some things are natural. Well, of course, that when you hear strikers talk like that, or hear players talk like that, I always think that, well, it's just because they don't have any real conscious thought behind what they do, or they don't give a lot of time to it. But they've been through them situations. It's all stored in the back of their head. They've been in those situations lots of times, so they've got them there to draw on. But it's really interesting to see how much he does think about the game and how much he wants to look at defenders and goalkeepers in particular. And it was, like I said, it's really interesting to know that he's not just relying on his physical traits, you know. And going back to what he's talking about, never giving up, that's the thing about him. He had exceptional traits as a player, even when he was outside of the league. You know, when he was, you know, his pace and his finishing ability, those are things that can take you forward and you can build something on, you can build a career on. It's a real bonus for us that those sort of exceptional abilities were seen by somebody, you know, that it was missed by a lot of other people. A lot, like you talked about, they weren't willing to take a chance on him. It's a bonus for us that, he's managed to be able to develop them and give them the chance to develop them.
I was really impressed by the breadth of his preparation. You know, when he talked about, you know, he's got a cryogenic chamber at home, got a hyperbaric equipment as well. That seems now to be the standard for a top pro, doesn't it?
It does. And I think for him, though, it shows how much he treasures being a professional footballer at the highest level. He had to work so hard to get there. He'll do anything to stay there for as long as he can. But yeah, it was very good. And I too was struck by his preparation, and he was the one who brought up how much he analyses his own performances and goalkeepers and defenders. Because yeah, at his age, you might think that they might be winding it down a little bit, and they might be just think, you know, just almost turning up. You know, how much longer can I eke this out for? But no, he's still looking to push on. Takes football very seriously. We all know about the sort of Jamie Vardy's having a party kind of you know, he's a life and soul, but he also takes that football very, very seriously. So yeah, and the modern players, obviously I guess he still came into it where there was a lot of focus on nutrition and fitness and mentality. I think before he came into professional football, it wasn't there. He's a product of the environment, which is just filled with experts. And I just think that all of this current generation just take it as read, that they're going to better themselves in terms of their mentality, in terms of their fitness and nutrition and health. So, yeah, it's quite normal in that respect.
I think I was listening to Stuart Pearce talking last week, and he talked about how he came into the game late, similar time to Jamie did. And he always felt that he was owed a few more years because he came into the game late. And obviously because of he probably hasn't as much toil on his body as perhaps somebody coming through, you know, playing more consistently in those sort of years between 16 and 21. So he probably can go on a little bit longer. But I also think that where he come from has been the thing that's taken him to where he's got to now. No, I thought you hit the nail on the head about you know, because he didn't come through that system, he was different. He was used to different things. When he came into the game, you know, he learned how to cope with physicality. He was direct. He'd been used to chasing balls over the top. All these things that perhaps not coached out of players, but certainly they're not used to doing in under-21s and under-18s games. So it just gives him a different dynamic there to what players who were brought through the system are used to doing.
Yeah, he was exposed, wasn't he, to the rougher elements of football, and it shaped him. But there are, you look around the Premier League, there are a few that you could probably say the same to. Mikel Antonio at West Ham, come through non-league, made it the hard way. He's a unique player, isn't he? He's not a prototype footballer. There are a number, really. I mean, Callum Wilson came through, Jared Bowen, Troy Deeney as well. These are players that have sort of, yeah. I think they are unique and individual players, and it's helped to shape them. I think all young footballers would benefit, and they won't all be given it, but they would all benefit from doing a little bit of time in non-league or in the lower leagues, absolutely, because it can and round you, not just as a footballer, actually, but round you as a person, hanging around other types of people as well.
I think there's certain positions that lends itself to more, certainly goalkeepers, strikers and central defenders. And talking to a lot of scouts, they're actually, when they're looking to scout central defenders, even for Championship and Premier League clubs, obviously at a young age, you're looking for players who have that robustness, who have something that the players at academy levels don't have. And
it's a tick. It's a positive. If on their CV they've had a spell at Dagenham and Redbridge, it's a tick.
Yeah, in a way. things are all about cycles. So, you know, you look at centre-halves and everyone's looking about a central defender who can play out from the back and is very technically very good. But then once it always goes too far one way, and then you think, well, they are very good with the ball, but they're not really a great defender. So then they try and look for people who can defend. It's all cyclical.
Yeah, well, to adapt to an old boxing phrase, actually, I think it was used by Mike Tyson, you know, everyone's got a plan until a centre-half elbows you in the face, haven't they, really? Just as a final point, Aid, you know, I was struck also by his admission that he owes a lot of his longevity to that decision to retire from the England team after the last World Cup. Do you think that's an understandable stance to take?
I do. I've always been a little bit critical of players that have sort of walked away from England, because I'm an England fan and I want the best players there and I want us to have the best chance of getting success. And I've always had that sort of idea that if your country needs you or asks for you do it. But for him, it was absolutely the right decision. And maybe as well, you've got to look at the situation, the scenario. Harry Kane is the main man. He's always going to play. So for him to spend that, you know, lengthy periods away from his family to train, you know, on those international breaks as hard as you would in every other week, it might not have been that sensible, given that he would get very few caps because Kane is the main man. And before that, it was Rooney. So, I understand it. And for him, it was totally the right thing to do. But I don't know, as an England supporter, I wouldn't have minded seeing him in action a bit more often.
Yeah. I'd like to end, if I could, chaps, on a bit more of a sobering note. Obviously, we know that the World Cup is stampeding at us across the horizon. As ex-pros, what do you think of squads of players like, you know, those of Australia speaking out publicly about uncomfortable issues relating to the Qatar World Cup? Do you think star players like them have a responsibility to use their platforms in that way? What about you think? What do you think, first of all, Dave?
I know Billy Wright, who's involved in the Australian squad and from a time at Sunderland, and to borrow a phrase from Brendan Rodgers, he's a fantastic human being. And he is the type of person who would lead on this. And I think it is really important. Now, of course, people might say, if you really feel that strongly about it and you really want to make a protest, then don't go. But I think that's for people higher up to take those sort of decisions for a team as a whole. But yeah, I'm all for it. And I think that at the end of the day, it's all about the effect it has, and can it have a real effect on what they're trying to do and what they're protesting against. And if in the future that there's authorities take notice of these protests and not drag themselves into a world where everything's more acceptable. I just think that it really is a brave thing for them to do as well, because they have come in for some criticism about stepping forward and putting their head above the parapet, but certainly I applaud them.
Yeah, it's got to be about more than, you know, pretty futile gestures like wearing an armband, isn't it, Aid?
Yeah, I think it's a powerful message, definitely. And I've got nothing but admiration for the players that are prepared to do it, and well done to them, kudos. But in the same breath, I don't think we should judge those that don't. I don't think there is a responsibility as such for all players and all teams to use their platform to send out these messages, because the bottom line is they're there to work, aren't they? They're there to win football matches. It's the pinnacle of their careers, and you know, they should really be concentrating on the football, which they all are. But I wouldn't criticise anybody for not putting their head above the parapet in the same breath. But for those that want to, I love the fact that Australian's Federation has given them the ability to get those messages out there. And I'm sure that if there are England players or Welsh players that want to do the same, that they won't be obstructed. I'd like to think they won't be. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the weeks to come. But look, for me, I'm just looking forward to the football. I want to forget where it is.
True. Well, it's an uncomfortable truth that global sports events can no longer be taken at face value. Sure, we're going to be drawn in by the daily diet of drama when the tournament gets underway in Qatar, but this World Cup doesn't exist in a vacuum. There are ethical, political, and financial aspects to consider. It's understandable and, in my opinion, laudable for players to challenge our consciences if they see fit. In that spirit, thanks to Jamie Vardy for his time, and of course, thanks to Adrian and David for their insights. Thanks also to you for your feedback.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.